All right, so who remembers where we were last week? Who remembers where we were last week? I would ask Jessie, but she's not here this morning. Our resident note taker is absent today, for class at least. Page 67, right? 14, 15, we sort of dealt with that, right? Jesus healing on the Sabbath, right? And this whole, you know, rebuke of the man who's, you know, got these problems with it. And, you know, it's Jesus is dining in the house of a Pharisee, right? You got this man who's got an edema-like condition where fluid's building up in his body. And Jesus basically asked the question on purpose, sort of poking the bear. Should I heal this man on the Sabbath or what? And that, of course, starts this discussion that they're at least having internally. Jesus calls him on it. And so he heals this man. He rebukes them for their attitudes about this particular day and the law in general. And so, you know, keep in mind, like we've said this before, and I've given some illustrations about how attitudes like this continue to this day, but rabbinical Judaism, and it sort of began before the time of the Pharisees, but it, by their time, it had evolved into, and it still is kind of this way today, in using certain portions of the law to justify not observing the others. And that's sort of problematic. But after this whole ordeal with the Sabbath day, right, Jesus opens his mouth and he begins to tell a parable, right, to everybody who's invited, right? We're in Luke chapter 14, verse 7 right now. And he begins to tell this parable to everybody who's invited. So why does he tell this parable to the people who are there? I know it's Mother's Day, so we've all may have had late nights or early mornings. But let's try and wake up. Why does he tell the parable that he's about to tell? The text tells us. No, the one before the wedding. We did the wedding, but we actually skipped over this one by accident. I totally neglected this out of wanting to move into the wedding feast. So I want to deal with it this morning. We did deal with the parable after this, the one that starts in verse 12, right? We dealt with that one, the parable of the great banquet, right? But the one that's from verses 7 to 11, we didn't deal with. We did? I don't think we did. No, we didn't. No, we totally didn't. We dealt with the one that starts in verse 12. So, there's two parables. Well, we dealt with the second one last week, but not with the first one. Oh, nobody? Yeah, this is about humility versus pride, right? Which maybe considering the subject of the sermon last week, I might have gotten into. But I mostly wanted to save the comments for the lesson itself, which is why I didn't delve into it now, because I felt like I would be repeating myself if I had done a large section of class about humility and pride and then got up to preach a lesson about humility and pride last week as well. So here Jesus tells a parable, and he tells it for a specific reason, and Luke gives us the reason why. So what's the reason? They're fighting over the best seats, right? Right. They're all sitting in the places where the most honorable and distinguished guests would sit, right? And it becomes this big parade over, you know, who's more noble than the others, right? And there's this, they're sorting out the pecking order, right? And things like that always seemed amusing to me, you know? They always seemed very, very amusing to me. Have you guys ever been a part of a situation where people are like, are doing that? Anybody? Like, what kind of situations have you usually found it to happen in? What's that? Oh, Cal's talking, going back to his youth in the Baptist church. Okay. That's direct. Okay. Anybody else? I'm just curious, right? Because I've only ever really seen this once in my life. It was a very kind of surreal experience for me. Oh, there's Janelle. It happens with family sometimes, right? Well, you know, I'll say, you know, speaking of family, there's, you know, certain at certain gatherings of the Curtis family, the Curtis brothers, not myself and Tim, but the Curtis brothers of a generation prior to us, all sort of like seem to be in competition with each other about who's more awesome. It's like, and it's highly disturbing. And that's the only time my Uncle Wayne will ever get competitive is when he's around my Uncle Gary. The only time, right? Because usually he's like the least competitive person you will meet. But something about my Uncle Gary just like, and it goes back a long way. And I'll tell you the story sometime, but not right now. And I'll tell you after class because it's actually kind of funny. If you want to hear the story, it's funny. But there's this one experience that I had that it seemed very strange to me. It happened in the Philippines. I don't know if Dedith remembers this or not. I remarked upon it at the time, but I don't know if she remembers it. Usually when kids get together, like, and there's a school thing going on, at least here, it's usually about the kids, right? Because we make a point because the kids are all, or the kids from a bunch of different schools are getting together to do something, and it's about them, right? And, you know, that's who gets talked about. We were at one scenario, we were at one occasion in the Philippines where there was like a parade where the elementary schools had their marching bands, which is basically percussion, right? They have bells, right? They don't have wind instruments, you know, funding being what it is. And do you remember this? No, you don't remember. Okay. So our nephew Charles was a part of it, right? And throughout the whole ordeal, right, before the whole thing began and all the kids started doing their thing, the person who was the master of ceremonies got up and gave this really long list of names. And it all started with the honorable person, you know, the honorable this person, the honorable that person, the honorable this third. And it was like 15 minutes of like names. I'm like, I may be exaggerating. It might have been 13, but you know. And it was just going on and on and on and on. And all these people were politicians. And it had frustrated me. Because here we are to, you know, watch the kids and celebrate something that the kids have worked really hard for. And the politicians are getting up and glory hounding themselves in front of the public. And it just seemed an extremely bad taste to me. Just exceptionally bad taste. But, you know, they're politicians. And then it's, when it was over, the same thing, again, for like 10, 15 minutes, over and over again, and then the politicians got up to make speeches, and not one of the single speeches was about the kids. Again, just seemed an exceptionally bad taste to me. Exceptionally bad taste. Do you remember that day now? Yeah, yeah. You remember? I remarked upon it at the time. I'm like, what in the world is wrong with this? But that, you know, that happened. And I found myself like, what in the world is going on here? But this happens in much more subtle ways on a daily basis. You know, think about seniority in the workplace. When someone wants time off, who gets it first? And there are these little disputes that erupt. And sometimes it gets, you know, when you're not involved, it's like, where's my popcorn? Right? But it actually turns into something tragic out now and then because we're basically fighting over whose ego is bigger and better and more powerful and deserves to be listened to. I mean, sometimes there's legitimate things, but a lot of the time, stuff just turns into an ego fest. And I'll tell you one thing. This happened one other time in my life as well. And this is a little hint of some things. The job that I do, right, necessitates me being in the public, right? I get up in front of everybody, and I have a captive audience for about half an hour, and then people start to, you know, fall asleep or wander off, right? It is what it is. You can only maintain people's attention as long as their butts are comfortable. But I have, and there's a thing about, you know, what we do, and I'm sure Lala will say this, is that, you know, having done it in the past for a couple years, you know, here and there, is that it's a job that forces you out into the public and forces you to be the center of attention. And if it's not, if you don't approach it with caution, there's a great possibility that your ego can get a little out of control. And I've seen preachers say from the pulpit, when I was a little kid, one guy in particular, that, you know, you guys would be nothing without me. You know, you guys would be lost without me. And I'm like, no, we'd be lost without Jesus. But, you know, last I checked, you ain't him. But, you know, it can feed the ego. It really can. In destructive ways. Which is why, you know, I go to this gathering of preachers in January, right? But that's the only one I go to, because I know there are others around, and I know where they are, and I know what time of the year they are. And people have said, hey, you ought to come. And I'm like, I don't know. Because I went to one that was some other place, and I'm around a bunch of other preachers, right? And that's supposed to be an edifying experience for us, right? We're supposed to be able to sit down and sort of talk and sort of decompress and delve into the Word and help each other out with our job, become better. But what it ended up turning to was a bunch of preachers competing, right, about, you know, who'd baptized more people throughout the year. I'm like, okay, well, you're in the Bible Belt, all right? I'm in California, okay? Let's just get real about certain things. But also they're competing and bragging about other aspects of the job, and I'm like, that's not a measurement of success, right? That's not even a measurement of greatness in the eyes of God, first of all. You're using human standards of greatness to evaluate yourself, and that's, you know, somewhat problematic. And so I stick to going to the one that I go to in January in San Diego for good reasons, because nobody does that there. Because the first time we ever had one of these things, when it started in L.A., the few of us who were there at the beginning said, we're not going to do that, and if we see it happening, we're just not going to have that person back next year. And we all said, okay, we've kept it that way, which is great. But David Barnes does it. He's been to that one once or twice, actually. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Well, he's seen things like that before, right? It's talking about David Barnes over Miller. He's got this saying, right, about preachers. It says, preachers are like manure. You spread them out and they fertilize the kingdom. You clump them together and they stink to high heaven. And, you know, sometimes there's something to that. And it's sad that you got, and I see Elmore's hand, I'll get to him in just a second, right? So remember your thought, right? So it's sad that you see that, because, I mean, if anything, that's unfortunately exactly what happens with the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees were the preachers of their day. They're the rabbis. And, you know, guess what? People who get up and do this job, if you're not careful, it can affect you in negative ways and feed into an unhealthy ego. And it happens, right? It happens today just like it happened then. And I was standing in this room, I thought to myself, my goodness, this must have been what Jesus felt like sitting down having dinner. Because it's just out of control. It's nuts. Right, Elmore. Right. Yeah. Not everyone should be doing this job, right? And part of it's just a natural skill set, and part of it is, even if you have the skill set, you shouldn't be doing it. You shouldn't be doing the job anyway, because you can't control your ego, right? And that whole discussion of how you use the tongue and the fact that James starts it off with saying that, you know, teachers, you know, preachers, they're going to be held to a higher standard regarding what they teach and what they say. That's what leads into our theme from last year, the wisdom from above versus the wisdom from below. There's Scripture actually has a lot to say directed toward people who take up this obligation, this position of service, and that, you know, if you're not careful and, you know, if you don't remember that it's an act of service, then, you know, that's when you should quit. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that verse gets to the heart of what's going on and what James talks about in James chapter 1, right? Where, you know, since Elmer went to James earlier, I'll just go there too. Which would you like to have happen in a public setting? Would you like to have someone say, no, you deserve a better place, you sit here? Or would you like to sit down in a position that is a position of honor and say, you don't deserve that spot, you go down there? You know, which one's nicer? I mean, one, you know, makes you feel good, and one honors you in the eyes of other people, and the other humiliates you, right? We talked about boasting last week, right, in the sermon. And there's people who have... I'm not saying boasting is an admirable quality, because it never really is. It's never admirable. But there are people who do it with finesse. Like Muhammad Ali, right? I mean, he was boasting, and it's still wrong, right? But at least he had finesse about it. And then there's other people, when they try to boast, it doesn't work, man. It just does not work. And that's what happens. You know, a lot of time people end up trying to make themselves look good, and it all comes crashing down around them because it's not true. And you end up just looking like a big fool. That's what Jesus is dealing with here, is this honor, humility versus pride. And getting into, if you really want people to look at you with respect, don't try and force it on them, because they'll respect you for that. But if you try and force it on them, they're not going to give you the respect you want. And that's just a general human practicality, right? And, you know, when people are fighting over, you know, who's better, it makes everyone else in the room uncomfortable. So we talked about the parable of the great banquet last week. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, boasting is a very worldly attribute, right? And, you know, in a lot of ways, our culture in particular here in America has devolved to an insane amount where, like, boasting has just gotten out of control, right? The thing about that is that we're just sort of getting back to status quo, right? You know, we're just going back to the way things have usually been throughout human history. I mean, more often than not, that's what it's like. And that's what it's been like. And you want to talk about boasting, right? It doesn't really get any more boastful than claiming that you're a living deity. Right? I mean, that's top-notch boasting right there, okay? So you got Pharaoh, and you got Alexander the Great, and you have, like, all of the Caesars before Constantinos, right? You've got all of them before Constantine. They knew how to boast, right? That's a worldly quality. And this brief breather where people have at least been professing biblical values, even if not actually living up to them, is a brief respite in the face of worldliness. And that, you know, we're just revolving back to the way things have usually been in human history. And that's just how it is. And part of what defines the wisdom from below is this arrogant boasting, right? In James chapter 3. That's part of the, we talked about that last year, right? So, we dealt with the parable of the great feast last week, or the great banquet last week. So I don't want to rehash that, except to say that, people who are invited keep giving excuses and excuses and excuses, right? And eventually, you know, the master of the house, the man who's hosting the banquet's like, okay, you don't want to come? You don't get to come. I'm going to invite everybody else, but you can't come. We talked about that last week, so we're not going to go over it again. But in verse 25, what we see is we see that word now, right? What does that indicate? In Luke's narrative, how does he use that as a narrative device? Some of that, change scene, right? It's a narrative break, right? New episode, right? The last episode has faded. We're dealing with a new episode now. So now, Jesus is in there. They're walking along. They're traveling around. Great crowds accompany him. And he turns to the crowds. I mean, and these are like the biggest crowds in his career. This is the largest multitude that's following him. This is when he is at his quote-unquote most successful, quote-unquote. And he turns around, and what does he say to the great crowds that are accompanying him? He says what? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brother and his sister, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Okay, so first of all, we're going to address a few things, right? Just the normal caveats to get it out of the way, right? Does Jesus mean you actually have to hate your family? No, okay. We're like... But why does he use this word? If he doesn't mean it, why does he use it? Carmel's right, the extreme, right? We basically took a Greek word, pulled it straight into English to describe this behavior, right? Hyperbole, right? That's a word that we use, we pronounce it hyperbole. But, you know, if you're in math, it's a hyperbola, right? Not hyperbole. You call it a hyperbola, but it's beside the point. But it's a word that means you exaggerate things to the extreme to make a point, right? Do we do this? Yeah. Does that mean the statement is untrue? Does that mean the statement is a lie? No, because everybody knows what we mean, okay? Right? The figures of speech, okay? Figures of speech. We're exaggerating to make a point, right? Right. To honor your parents, right? Yeah, and Jesus is being vivid to... And by the way, he does this a lot, by the way. Jesus exaggerates a whole lot. And, you know, I hear people, like, occasionally... who are older, not liking the way some younger people talk because they exaggerate everything, right? It's like, okay, well, here's my defense. Jesus did it. Woohoo! So relax. But Jesus exaggerated a lot, right? And he said, if your right hand causes you to sin, do what? Cut it off, right? Okay, can your hand cause you to sin in the first place? Like, maybe if you have Tourette's, I don't know. But no. And even in that case, you're not in control. So it's not even, you know, you can't blame somebody for that in the first place because they're not, it's not under their control to begin with, right? So it can't even cause you to sin. So you don't have to cut it off, right? If your right eye causes you to sin, do what? Tear it out, right? Okay, well, your eye cannot cause you to sin, okay? So, I mean, if you want to rock an eye patch because you think they look cool, whatever, right? But don't actually, like, not good. So he deals with exaggeration a lot to make this point. He paints a very vivid image with pictures that's sometimes outlandish on purpose to get people to stop and think about it, right? And Matthew's analysis of this event, what he says, if anyone loves father or mother more than me, he is not worthy of me, right? So Matthew records what he actually says, or, you know, it's possible that he's saying this on two different instances. I mean, that's the way these events certainly seem to break down that way. Matthew's recording a separate event. So on one instance, Jesus makes the exaggeration to make the point. On the other instance, Jesus delivers it just straight up, right? But these two instances, he's teaching the same thing. They're parallel teachings, if not, they're not parallel passages, right? So in the instance that Matthew records, Jesus says, if anyone loves father or mother more than me, he's not worthy of me. If anyone loves son or daughter more than me, he is not worthy of me. And so he's making the point, and he's being vivid and outlandish on purpose. But there's also something else going on, right? There's one other reason why he would say this. Why would he say this? At this point in time. Because this is when he has the largest amount of people following him. Why would he say it now? And I can think of two reasons that have to do with that fact. Anybody want to take a stab, or just want me to go ahead and lay it out? Anybody? Okay, I guess I'm just going to go ahead and lay it out. Number one, this is when he's got the most people listening to him. And this is one of the most important messages that he has to deliver. What's the first commandment in the Ten Commandments? No, in the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods in my presence. You shall have no other gods in my presence. And if you want to do it the way the Jews and the Catholics organize it, which is fine by me, because I actually kind of prefer it that way, the first commandment in its full form is, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods in my presence. Because they include that statement as part of the first commandment. I think that's actually a good addition. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods in my presence. And this is essentially Jesus saying the same message, right? You know, Paul says in Ephesians 4, there's one Lord, right? Who's that? Who's the one Lord Paul is talking about in Ephesians 4? Yeah, Jesus, okay, yeah. Yeah, that's the point. That's it. And so Jesus is delivering, you know, this is the most important thing they're going to hear. I mean, everything else stems from this, right? Everything else that he has to say rests on this single foundation. You shall have no other lords, no other gods in my presence. None. So, Jesus paints the vivid imagery to make that point. And he says it while he's got the biggest crowds of his life following him. Number one, because that's what people need to hear. And he can deliver. I mean, this is distribution, right? This is the prime target for that message. This is the biggest crowd he's ever going to have. Now's the moment to drop that. Number two, there's another reason why he does it when he's got the biggest crowds of his life following him. It's to sift the crowd. That's the purpose. It's to sift the crowd. And that's evident from what happens next. So we're going to read that. By the way, before we move on, Elmore, is there something you had to say? Right. You know, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me, right? If anyone would come after me, let him first deny himself, then take up his cross, and then follow me. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot follow me, right? And what he does is he goes from there, and he does something. He tells a story, right? Or he poses a hypothetical illustration, right? Says, let's engage in a thought experiment. So what's this thought experiment? What does he ask people to think about? What's that? Okay, if you were building a tower, how would you go about it? Right? Wouldn't you first do what? What does he say? Make sure you have the resources required to complete the project. Right? You'd make sure that all things are in place for the construction project, right? Okay, number two, the second part of it. If you were what? If you're a king and you're going out to make war against another king and you've got 10,000 and he's got 20,000, wouldn't you first do what? Calculate, Elmore says. Calculate what? Whether you can win or not. And it's interesting that he says whether you can win or not, because he's outnumbered 2-1. But if you're outnumbered 2-1, you can still win, right? You can still win. How do you win? Well, you have a better plan of the problem. Well, and that's important. You have better strategic planning, right? Let's not forget logistics. That's actually probably the most important thing in warfare. You got to have a supply train, because if you can't get stuff to your soldiers, they're going to die no matter how good your plan is, right? I mean, just ask Napoleon and Hitler when they invaded Russia. Oh, bad mistake. But also, I mean, your strategical planning and your tactical execution is important too. Your tactical execution on the battlefield is exceptionally important. But who is the war won by? Not generals. Soldiers. You can defeat an enemy force that outnumbers you easily. Just ask the Spartans how to do it. They knew, because they were better soldiers. And that's the foundation for the illustrations that he goes into. Because, you know, we look at the first one, right? And for time and time and time again, what I always heard growing up as a kid, like on the pews, was what Jesus is saying is you have to be willing to count the cost of being a disciple, right? You guys have heard sermons like that. Lala's probably delivered sermons like that. Your dad's probably done something. Scott's probably done something. You probably heard stuff like that, you know? This is an easy lesson to do, right? Because Jesus asked the question there in the text. And I'm not saying that's not a part of what Jesus is saying. And, you know, it probably is. But I think there's a secondary, I think that's not the primary thing he's saying. Because again, think of the context. Jesus says what he says to sift the crowd. And it's kind of obvious that's what he's doing, is he's sifting the crowd. Because do you honestly think that Jesus doesn't know that what he says is going to drive some people away? That some people aren't going to be able to handle it, or they're not going to understand that he's talking in hyperbole, or even if they do, they're like, I don't know, man, family's family. You think Jesus doesn't know that? I mean, he has a reasonably good understanding of human nature, you know, having created us and all, and, you know, been around to observe us since our existence, even if not on the earth, and, you know, being eternal himself, he's observed us for our entire history. So he has a reasonably good understanding of human nature, and a reasonable expectation of our behavior, but there's something going on here. Elmore? Right. And there's definitely something to that. And that's a lesson that's certainly taught in Scripture, right? And you know, Jesus even sort of asked the question here. So, but I still don't think that's his primary point. And I'll tell you why, right? Why in the world is he talking about a builder and a king? Why is he talking about a builder, first of all? Yeah, let's go to Hebrews 11. Let's everybody go to Hebrews 11. What was Abraham looking for? A city. What kind of city? A city whose architect and builder is God. Right? Beginning in verse 8, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. The Messiah's mission in Isaiah chapter 4, chapter 61, verses 1 through 4, what is it? It's to heal the sick, to set free the captives, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to bind up the brokenhearted, to fix people, right? On a deep spiritual level, to fix people. But the people who get fixed, what does verse 4 say they're going to do? It says they're going to go up and start building themselves, right? This is this whole Babylon versus Zion. I mean, Jesus used the word tower here, right? He's building a lot of towers, isn't he? He's building a whole city. You know, not a physical city, but a metaphysical, a metaphorical, a spiritual place, right? What's that city, by the way? What's it called in Scripture? The Messiah's city? Zion. What's Zion? What does Isaiah say Zion is? And how do the New Testament writers apply Isaiah talking about Zion? That's it? It's the church. It's the church. That's Zion, right? Zion's the church. That's the Zion Isaiah is talking about anyway. It's the church. And so Jesus is in the process of building Zion, right? And by the way, what does Peter say about this process of construction, about and how we relate to it? What are we? Oh, we're the stones used in the construction, right? That's 1 Peter chapter 2, right? Oh, we're the stones used in the construction. We're not the builder. We're the construction materials. So, when we talk about armies going to war, who's the king? Jesus. Oh. And what does Paul call our enemy in Ephesians chapter 6? What title does he give him? As far as royalty is concerned, he calls him a prince. Oh, we're getting a little deeper, huh? I'll get to Elmore in just a second. Yeah, well, it was about the whole Ephesians 6 thing, Elmore? Yeah, yeah. And that's about, you know, Jesus versus, you know, Moses, right? Moses is not a king. He's just a part of the kingdom, right? Moses is a stone just like the rest of us. Now that's starting to color what we read in Luke 14 a little differently, isn't it? To understand it a little better. Because is God outnumbered? Are God's people outnumbered? Yeah. Yes. Right? Yeah. And I like how Alexia said, is God outnumbered? And her answer was no. Right? Which actually reminds me of something that Abraham Lincoln once said. He was trying to make a difficult decision about something in the Civil War, and his entire cabinet was against him. The whole cabinet. And he said, okay, we'll put it to a vote. The entire cabinet voted against him. They all said nay. And he said, well, the ayes have it. And they were upset. And he said, well, you've forgotten. You're my cabinet. I'm the president. I constitute a majority of one. So, you know, there you go. So this passage in Luke changes now. Especially with him saying what he says in that moment. helps us understand what's going on here. And so the passage changes from, are you willing to count the cost and make the sacrifices necessary, to, and no, although that's truly a biblical lesson, right? Let's not denigrate that message, right? That's an important part of who we are and what we do and why we do it. But Jesus is doing something else here. So I'll ask you guys a question. Does God want everybody? Yeah. Okay, how do we know that? Because he said so. Thank you, Pat and Cal. Where does he say so? In the Bible, right? It's 2 Peter chapter 3, right? 2 Peter chapter 3. And there's John 3:16, right? But 2 Peter chapter 3, I think, is a little bit more apropos to our situation, right? God is long-suffering, right? Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And that's the key, right? So does God want everybody? And I'm going to ask you again, does God want everybody? Does God want everybody? The answer is both yes and no. I was going to say, the answer is both yes and no. God only wants a certain kind of person. He will only take a certain kind of person. But he wants everybody to be that kind of person. Right? And that's what Jesus is saying here. And that's what, when you combine the situation he's in with what he says, and then the story, the illustrations he uses, this is the meaning of the text. Elmore. Right. I mean, as soon as we go from Adam and Eve, right? What's the next sin that's listed in Scripture aside from Adam and Eve? Right? And the eating of the fruit that was forbidden. What happens in Genesis 4? Oh, we don't remember that, huh? Cain and Abel. When God accepted Abel's sacrifice, but he didn't accept Cain's sacrifice, Cain was walking around all frustrated and grumpy and sad. What did God say to him? He says, he has that, you know, are you okay, right? Why are you sad? And Cain pouts for a little while, right? It's like the text sort of implies that they're both men because they knew what was right from wrong. They were sort of doing their thing on their own by this point. But it's like, okay, dude, you're acting like Arya, okay? You shouldn't be pouting like a 5-year-old. Right? And God essentially redresses him like that, right? He redresses Cain. He rebukes him. He says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do well, will I not accept you? But behold, sin is crouching at the door. And it wants to rule over you. But you have to control it. Right? And that's what he says to Cain. And that's been the message since day one. That has been the message since day one. Sin wants to rule over you, but you have to control it. And that's the bottom line. And that's what distinguishes, right? The good stones from the bad ones. You know, and he says, will you not first count the cost? You know, it's not just a financial thing. It's an assessment of the entire project. Do you have the quality of materials that are, I mean, you know, when you're talking about building a structure, the quality of the materials that you use is extremely important, right? You know, if you're trying to build a skyscraper and you're thinking about using balsa wood, all right, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a really, really big problem. Actually, it's not going to be that big because it won't get that tall. It'll just collapse. But you know, you have to provide adequate structural support. You know, you have to make sure, I mean, you know, building here in America, you got to make sure everything's up to code, right? You got to get your licenses, your building permits done. There's an entire logistical process that has to happen along with the actual physical construction. You got to make sure all that is done and everything is in order. Have you done what is necessary? And Jesus is saying, I have, and I'm about to, right? And then he uses this illustration of a king going to war. I mean, how often is warfare used as a metaphor for how we live and how we fight against sin and against Satan? Like, a lot, right? This is a very familiar thing, right? And it goes back to the prophets, right? Like Ezekiel 38, okay? It goes back to the prophets here. And Jesus is just bringing that forward. And the New Testament writers just bring that forward. They say, look, and Jesus is saying, I'm a king, and my army's outnumbered. Right? So if you're going to defeat an army that outnumbers your army, what do you got to have? You got to have good soldiers. What does Paul tell Timothy to be? A good soldier for Jesus Christ. I mean, and that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with Jesus just bringing all this forward and saying, look, and the purpose behind saying what he says to sift the crowd is to get the people who are really there. So, I mean, he wants everybody to be there, right? But some people are just, they're not going to be there. And he wants to be able, and think, this is getting toward the end now, right? It's just a couple months before he's going to die. And he knows that. And he's like, I'm going to focus the rest of my remaining time on the people who are really here. So I can work with them and help them become what they need to be before I leave. Elmore. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that's what Jesus gets to, right? So, make sure you're in it for the long haul. Because I am, he says. And I will accept nothing less than your best. Because that's what I've given for you. Right? So, therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. I mean, I think with that, looking at everything in context with the rest of Scripture, it becomes pretty clear, right? That's what he's talking about. I have a standard, and you have to meet that standard. So, and this thing about salt fits perfectly with that. Salt is good, right? But if salt has lost its flavor, its saltiness, what is it good for? First of all, how in the world can salt lose its saltiness? Really? How old is it? Okay, but we're also dealing with... Yeah, but what we're not dealing with, salt that's been purified and iodized, like salt we have now, right? We're dealing with salt that's been mined from salt flats or mined from the ocean, sea salt, right? But it hasn't been purified. Like, even sea salt now, we process it and refine it, right? But they didn't do that back then. So you have salt, but it's got all these other minerals mixed in it, right? And so one of the properties of salt is that it absorbs things really well. That's why we put it on roadways, right? In the wintertime, we did it when we were in New England. When I was, that year and a half I was in New England, they do that. But the thing about that is salt absorbs things around it, right? Which makes it great for, it raises, or it lowers the melting point, right, of water, but increases the boiling point. But at the same time, it absorbs minerals around it, which corrupts the salt, but also, it makes you have to engage in road maintenance a whole lot more when you put it on the roads. And so a lot of New England towns have budget problems because of that. We're dealing with salt that's not like the salt we have today. But when that happens and it ceases to be, pure sodium chloride, and it's got all this other stuff in it, and like the process of absorption has just totally corrupted the salt, that you can't really call it salt anymore, right? What's it good for? Nothing. You throw it out. And that's the point Jesus is making. Now, there's sort of a corollary to this, though, right? And first of all, what did salt represent in the law of Moses? I promise we're going to close soon. What did salt represent in the law of Moses? Oh, this is in the depths of the opening chapters of Leviticus. It's one of those things that we went over, but we don't go over it very much. It represented the covenant that God made with Israel. And Leviticus even calls it the salt of the covenant, right? And whenever they came to offer sacrifice before God, God said, don't you dare forget the salt of the covenant and all of your offerings that you bring before me. Don't you dare forget it. And it's interesting that Jesus uses this, right, as a sign for holiness, because he's drawing on Leviticus. And he's drawing on imagery that to the Jews would be exceptionally familiar. Don't you dare forget the salt. And if you're the salt and you've lost your salty qualities, your saltiness, you're good for nothing. Now, the corollary to that is, getting into Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, right? How can salt be made salty again? I don't know if I have the chemistry to be able to help you, right? But on a metaphysical level, how can salt be made salty again? That's what Jesus came here to do. To give us our saltiness back. People talk about, certain sins and consequences, and they said you can't unscramble the egg, right? Sometimes there are physical consequences for sin, yeah. That's a part of it. But spiritually speaking, Jesus came to unscramble all of the eggs. That's what he came here to do. Jesus came to make people salty again. That's why he's here. And that's another point behind what he's saying here. Is, you know what? You're good for nothing unless you let me fix you. Because I can do that. And if you're not ready, I can make you ready. So that's where we're going to close. The end of our lesson. We're going to pick up with lesson 18, page 69 next week. Luke chapter 15 and 16. So thank you everybody for being here. And for your attendance and participation, we're going to close our class out with that now. And men of the congregation, please remember to meet in the back to make Brother Cooper's job easier. Thank you, everybody, very much.